might spur you on. Under the influence of an opponent like La Catalina, you may have to make use of everything I've taught you. You don't have any other alternative. We were quiet for a while. His words had aroused a tremendous apprehension in me. He then wanted me to imitate, as close as possible, the cry I had heard after I'd said buenas noches. I attempted to reproduce the sound and came up with some weird howling that scared me. Don Juan must have found my rendition funny. He laughed almost uncontrollably. Afterwards, he asked me to reconstruct the total sequence, the distance I ran, the distance the woman was from me at the time I encountered her, the distance she was from me at the time I reached the house, and the place where she had begun hopping. No fat Indian woman could hop that way, he said after assessing all those variables. They couldn't even run that far. He made me hop. I couldn't cover more than 4 feet each time, and if I were correct in my perception, the woman had hopped at least 10 feet with each leap. Of course, you know that from now on, you must be on the lookout, he said in a tone of great urgency. She'll try to tap you on your left shoulder during a moment when you're unaware and weak. What should I do? I asked. It's meaningless to complain, he said. What's important from this point on is the strategy of your life. I couldn't concentrate at all on what he was saying. I took notes automatically. After a long silence, he asked if I had any pain behind my ears or in the nape of my neck. I said no, and he told me that if I had experienced an uncomfortable sensation in either of those two areas, it would have meant that I had been clumsy and that La Catalina had injured me. Everything you did that night was clumsy, he said. First of all, you went to the party to kill time, as though there's any time to kill. That weakened you.
You mean I shouldn't go to parties?
No, I don't mean that. You may go to any place you wish, but if you do, you must assume the full responsibility for that act. A warrior lives his life strategically. He would attend a party or a reunion like that only if his strategy calls for it. That means, of course, that he would be in total control and would perform all the acts that he deems necessary.
He looked at me fixedly and smiled, then covered his face and chuckled softly.
You're in a terrible bind, he said. Your opponent's on your trail, and for the first time in your life you can't afford to act helter-skelter. This time, you'll have to learn a totally different doing, the doing of strategy. Think of it this way. If you survive the onslaughts of La Catalina, you'll have to thank her someday for having forced you to change your doing.
What a terrible way of putting it, I exclaimed. What if I don't survive?
A warrior never indulges in thoughts like that, he said. When he has to act with his fellow men, a warrior follows the doing of strategy, and in that doing there are no victories or defeats. In that doing, there are only actions.
I asked him what the doing of strategy entailed.
It entails that one's not at the mercy of people, he replied. At that party, for instance, you were a clown, not because it served your purposes to be a clown, but because you placed yourself at the mercy of those people. You never had any control, and thus you had to run away from them.
What should I have done?
Not go there at all, or else go there to perform a specific act. After horsing around with the Mexicans, you were weak, and La Catalina used that opportunity, so she placed herself in the road to wait for you. Your body knew that something was out of place, though, and yet you spoke to her. That was terrible. You mustn't utter a single word to your opponent during one of those encounters. Then, you turned your back to her. That was even worse. Then, you ran away from her. And that was the worst thing you could have done. Apparently, she's clumsy. A sorcerer that's worth his salt would have mowed you down right then, the instant you turned your back and ran away. So far, your only defense is to stay put and do your dance.
What dance are you talking about? I asked.
He said that the rabbit thumping he had taught me was the first movement of the dance that a warrior groomed and enlarged throughout his life, and then executed in his last stand on earth. I had a moment of strange sobriety, and a series of thoughts occurred to me. On one level, it was clear that what had taken place between me and La Catalina the first time I'd confronted her was real. La Catalina was real, and I couldn't discard the possibility that she was actually following me. On the other level, I couldn't understand how she was following me, and this gave rise to the faint suspicion that Don Juan might be tricking me, and that he himself was somehow producing the weird effects I had witnessed. Don Juan suddenly looked at the sky and told me that there was still time to go and check the sorceress. He reassured me that we were running very little danger because we were only going to drive by her house.
You must confirm her shape, Don Juan said. Then there won't be any doubts left in your mind, one way or the other.
My hands began to sweat profusely, and I had to dry them repeatedly with a towel. We got in my car, and Don Juan directed me to the main highway, and then to a wide, unpaved road. I drove in the center of it. Heavy trucks and tractors had carved deep trenches, and my car was too low to go on either the left or the right side of the road. We went slowly, amid a thick cloud of dust. The coarse gravel which was used to level the road had lumped with dirt during the rains, and chunks of dry mud rocks bounced against the metal underside of my car, making loud, explosive sounds. Don Juan told me to slow down as we were coming to a small bridge. There were four Indians sitting there, and they waved at us. I wasn't sure whether or not I knew them. We passed the bridge, and the road curved gently.
"That's the woman's house," Don Juan whispered to me as he pointed with his eyes to a white house with a high bamboo fence all around it.
He told me to make a U-turn and stop in the middle of the road and wait to see if the woman became suspicious enough to show her face. We stayed there perhaps 10 minutes. I thought it was an interminable time. Don Juan didn't say a word. He sat motionless, looking at the house.
"There she is," he said, and his body gave a sudden jump.
I saw the dark, foreboding silhouette of a woman standing inside the house, looking through the open door. The room was dark, and that only accentuated the darkness of the woman's silhouette. After a few minutes, the woman stepped out of the darkness of the room and stood in the doorway and watched us. We looked at her for a moment, and then Don Juan told me to drive on. I was speechless. I could have sworn that she was the woman I'd seen hopping by the road in the darkness. About half an hour later, when we turned onto the paved highway, Don Juan spoke to me.
"What do you say?" he asked. "Did you recognize the shape?"
I hesitated for a long time before answering. I was afraid of the commitment entailed in saying yes. I carefully worded my reply and said that I thought it had been too dark to be completely sure. He laughed and tapped me gently on my head.
"She was the one, wasn't she?" he asked.
He didn't give me time to reply. He put a finger to his mouth in a gesture of silence and whispered in my ear that it was meaningless to say anything, and that in order to survive La Catalina's onslaughts, I had to make use of everything he had taught me. Part 2. Journey to Islan. 18. The Sorcerer's Ring of Power. In May of 1971, I paid Don Juan the last visit of my apprenticeship. I went to see him on that occasion in the same spirit I'd gone to see him during the 10 years of our association. That is to say,
I was once again seeking the amenity of his company. His friend, Don Genaro, a Mazatec Indian sorcerer, was with him. I'd seen both of them during my previous visit 6 months earlier. I was considering whether or not to ask them if they had been together all that time, when Don Genaro explained that he liked the northern desert so much that he'd returned just in time to see me. Both of them laughed, as if they knew a secret.
"I came back just for you," Don Genaro said.
"That's true," Don Juan echoed.
I reminded Don Genaro that the last time I'd been there, his attempts to help me to stop the world had been disastrous for me. That was my friendly way of letting him know that I was afraid of him. He laughed uncontrollably, shaking his body and kicking his legs like a child. Don Juan avoided looking at me, and also laughed.
"You're not going to try to help me anymore, are you, Don Genaro?" I asked.
My question threw both of them into spasms of laughter. Don Genaro rolled on the ground, laughing, then lay on his stomach and began to swim on the floor. When I saw him doing that, I knew I was lost. At that moment, my body somehow became aware that I'd arrived at the end. I didn't know what that end was. My personal tendency to dramatization and my previous experience with Don Genaro made me believe that it might be the end of my life. During my last visit to them, Don Genaro had attempted to push me to the brink of stopping the world. His efforts had been so bizarre and direct that Don Juan himself had had to tell me to leave. Don Genaro's demonstrations of power were so extraordinary and so baffling that they forced me to a total reevaluation of myself. I went home, reviewed the notes that I'd taken in the very beginning of my apprenticeship, and a whole new feeling mysteriously set in on me, although I hadn't been fully aware of it until I saw Don Genaro swimming on the floor. The act of swimming on the floor, which was congruous with other strange and bewildering acts he'd performed in front of my very eyes, started as he was lying face down. He was first laughing so hard that his body shook as in a convulsion. Then he began kicking. And finally, the movement of his legs became coordinated with a paddling movement of his arms, and Don Genaro started to slide on the ground as if he were lying on a board fitted with ball bearings. He changed directions various times and covered the entire area of the front of Don Juan's house, maneuvering around me and Don Juan. Don Genaro had clowned in front of me before, and every time he'd done it, Don Juan had asserted that I had been on the brink of seeing. My failure to see was a result of my insistence on trying to explain every one of Don Genaro's actions from a rational point of view. This time, I was on guard, and when he began to swim, I didn't attempt to explain or understand the event. I simply watched him. Yet I couldn't avoid the sensation of being dumbfounded. He was actually sliding on his stomach and chest. My eyes began to cross as I watched him. I felt a surge of apprehension. I was convinced that if I didn't explain what was happening, I would see, and that thought filled me with an extraordinary anxiety. My nervous anticipation was so great that in some way I was back at the same point, locked once more in some rational endeavor. Don Juan must have been watching me. He suddenly tapped me. I automatically turned to face him, and for an instant, I took my eyes away from Don Genaro. When I looked at him again, he was standing by me with his head slightly tilted and his chin almost resting on my right shoulder. I had a delayed, startled reaction. I looked at him for a second, and then I jumped back. His expression of feigned surprise was